Welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable for the Commonwealth Club of California from Monday, December 12th, 2016. This was the week that we learned that President-elect Donald Trump has been skipping most of his national security briefings. Someone suggested that Saturday Night Live include intelligence briefings as part of the show because he'll never miss them then. So that's an idea they may want to consider. So thanks for joining us here in San Francisco today. I'm John Zipperer, your host for Week to Week, and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. So, throughout pretty much the last 18 months, many of you, in fact, some of you may have written these things, sent them up saying, could you please stop talking about Donald Trump? Not going to happen. Just giving you a heads up. Clearly, we cannot do that now. However, we will be starting a new Russian language edition of Week to Week. So on today's program, we're going to be talking, of course, about the president-elect and his transition team, that is, some local and state election results, the future of sanctuary cities, which, of course, includes a number of them right here in the Bay Area, some other political news, and we'll even review some of the highlights and lowlights of 2016, and we'll end the evening with our news quiz. I always note that the Commonwealth Club is a place for people of all views. So everyone is welcome, and any opinions that are expressed are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now, let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start at the far end of the stage with Molly Riley. She's the deputy politics editor at Huffington Post, and she's on Twitter at Molly Riley. Next to her is Dr. James Taylor, professor of political science and the director of African American Studies at the University of San Francisco. And joining our panel for the first time is Stephen Tavares. He's the founder of the hyperlocal government and politics news site called the East Bay Citizen. Stephen is also a former colleague of mine here at the Commonwealth Club, so we're very pleased to have him back joining us. And he's on Twitter at East Bay Citizen. So as you know, there are question cards spread throughout the room. Write down some questions. We'll collect them and send them up, and I will try to ask as many as I can during the program. On to our round table. I want to begin, of course, with the news that broke over the weekend about Russian hacking of the election. On Friday, it was reported that President Obama has ordered a review of alleged Russian interference in the recent U.S. presidential election. The CIA believes that Russia worked to ensure Democrat Hillary Clinton lost the election. The FBI reportedly is a little bit more circumspect, but this has obviously dominated the news. And so let's start there, and I'm going to start on the end with Molly. What do we know so far, and what do you make of this?
So what we know so far is that the CIA has found evidence that the Russian government somehow meddled with the election, deliberately did so to benefit Trump. So there was indications earlier on that they had interfered in the election, but the new news here is that it was clearly motivated by getting Donald Trump elected. So I think there's a lot going on here that's really interesting. First of all, the timing. We're about to have the Electoral College vote in a few days, and this is obviously something that is going to be at the top of their minds. You know, I think there's a lot of hope right now that they can get intelligence briefings, that they can get a little bit more detail on this before they have to vote. Whether or not that's going to happen remains to be seen. And then I think another interesting point about this is Republicans are coming out pretty strongly in saying that this needs to be investigated. So I think we've all been wondering how Republicans in Congress are going to be dealing with Donald Trump and whether they would stand up to him. And so this is a pretty clear indicator that there are some issues that they will. So we're seeing that already on this.
Sure.
James, what do you- Mitch McConnell came out today and I think forthrightly set some distance between him and the Trump position. And I think this is a real sign that there's not going to be a simple rubber stamp coming from the Republicans. I think it's a real issue. For me, what I've been talking to my students about after this election, and as much as I try to be open-minded about all the different factors, I've been watching this thing and been on top of this entire process for 18 months or 2 years. But to me, it's reducible to simply one thing. And I know, most people would reject such reductionism. But to me, with all of the shortcomings of Hillary Clinton and her campaign, even the offense of Bernie, all of the things that Hillary's campaign did wrong, and she ran one of the best campaigns anybody's ever seen and still lost, at least in the Electoral College vote. But it seems to me that the Russian hacks and James Comey and WikiLeaks, is the only explanation anybody needs for what happened in 2016. With Hillary Clinton's shortcomings, with her server problems, with strategic issues, everything we can enumerate and say this is why Hillary lost, she was winning with a 90% probability of winning,
Yeah. Even
with all of these shortcomings. And then James Comey's actions. This would be like J. Edgar Hoover decided whether Nixon or Kennedy would be president in 2000 and favored one over the other. And we're laughing about it. This is the most serious thing that's happened to this country, I think, since 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina.
And
I think the tragedy that the president-elect is dismissing this as simply partisanship ignores the very serious national security threat that this represents in terms of what WikiLeaks has done. I've said on my Facebook page, and I'll say it here publicly, that I really do believe Hillary Clinton suffered a coup d'etat. I think she was the victim of a coup. I think the collaboration of the powerful KGB, the FBI, and WikiLeaks would destroy any of us. It is insane that people are looking at other explanations apart from what James Comey did. It was just like the, what do you call it? What was the disease that they said everyone was going to get in 2012? It was Ebola, remember? Ebola. Everybody was talking about Ebola in 2012, leading up to Obama's reelection. As soon as he was reelected, nobody talked about this African disease anymore. And now that Hillary's lost, nobody's heard from James Comey.
Yeah. Now, so you said the CIA, the FBI, I mean, those groups. Are you saying...
No, I didn't say CIA. FBI and WikiLeaks and KGB, those three specifically.
Okay, so...
I think they collaborated, whether intentionally or intentionally. Yeah. It's almost irrelevant whether there was collaboration, because the effect was to undermine what was clearly a leading campaign. There was no reason why Hillary Clinton should have lost with all that she had in terms of shortcomings, except for James Comey's actions.
So in the green room before this, Stephen and I were talking about a local accusation of some hacking. Tell us about that.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with the, if you're in the East Bay or San Jose area in the last campaign, you probably saw Ro Khanna and Mike Honda commercials, especially at late night TV. It was one after another, Mike Honda and... He alleged that Ro Khanna was a, quote, Russian hacker because, it really means something now. They're like, wow, was it Comey? Was a double agent? Ro Khanna's a, who else?
Yeah.
There could be, I'm just putting this out. There could be a double agent in here.
They came for the champagne.
Mother over there, she's a double agent. But, so that that actually is probably the Khanna Honda accusation, the Honda against Khanna, actually has more evidence than some of these what's going on here in nationally.
So wait, you're saying there's more evidence for that?
There's more Khanna evidence.
He did.
I'm not saying he did, or I'm just saying there's more evidence. There may at least equal in circumstantial evidence, because a lot of this stuff that we're hearing from CIA and the FBI and who whatever source is talking to NBC and whatever source is talking to CNN, there doesn't seem to be anybody is saying for sure this is happening. And it kind of reminds me of I cover more local stuff in the East Bay, and it reminds me of the situation with the stadium for the Raiders, where you're talking to NFL people. And so one journalist from Yahoo is talking to one owner who's against the Raiders movement. And then the other guy from wherever outlet, national outlet, is saying, well, I'm hearing my sources, another owner, saying that they should stay. Or they should, this kind of seems like the same thing, where somebody is saying that some FBI source, senior source, whatever they call it, is telling one outlet one thing, that there's nothing to this, and somebody else is saying, there's a lot here. But what we're hearing is it's circumstantial. I don't know. And this is my theory of what's going on from a media angle, is I think what's going on is that and probably comes from the Democratic Party. They're trying to put the stamp right now when the president-elect is kind of, you know, his presidency is not hardened yet. It's very soft. You can put an imprint on and then let it stick.
Him.
They're defining him now, and this is going to be what Democrats are going to define him as, some sort of, you know, we're going to relitigate, I don't know if words that, litigate, the Cold War again. And which seems to me like, I thought we won that, but we could use it again. So that is how I read this. And the timing you were saying about, you know, the Electoral College is coming on. So that's my cynical media view.
There's a more cynical view, and that is from John Bolton, who is tagged to be the Deputy Secretary of State. And he suggested that this Russian hacking thing was a false flag operation by the Obama administration, meaning that he thinks, or at least he's saying, that the Obama administration did it in order to have something to discredit the president-elect. Let's move on from that, because this is related. Donald Trump says he does not need a daily intelligence briefing because he's, and I quote, smart, unquote.
I guess we as a country are just in need for one big laugh, because this is not funny. This is scary. This is existential. And I think the laughter we're hearing is really fear, that we are actually afraid of what we've done.
Right.
Like Brexit. And I think people are laughing because they just think this system will survive Donald Trump because it has survived everyone else. Well, and if we just keep laughing, it will all go away because it can't be serious. And yet, all of the things lining up show that Donald Trump is not playing with us.
That's right. A couple of us were talking about this earlier also. Did anyone see David Frum when he was on Bill Maher just before the election? Okay. David Frum kept trying to make a point, and unfortunately Bill Maher was kind of hyperactive and wasn't listening. But David Frum, who's a Republican, former Bush, George W. Bush speechwriter, came out and said, look, I'm a conservative Republican. I don't like Hillary Clinton's views, but it is a patriotic duty to vote for Hillary Clinton. Okay, so he burned whatever bridges he still has left with certain wings of the Republican Party. What he was saying on that show was, and this I think gets right to your point, was we need to be focusing on the institutions, you know, in government and civil society and things, because if you're worried that Donald Trump is going to, you know, just run rampant, if you will, those institutions are the bulwark against that. And I don't think a lot of people really want to think about institutions because it's boring.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's get into what we have been seeing. And I imagine there are probably a few Trump voters out there who are not happy with me at the moment. But let's talk about what we have been seeing with the transition so far. It got off to a slow and kind of rocky start, but they've been rolling out a lot of big names. And, you know, again, Molly, you first. What are some of the names that jump out at you as either surprising, positive, negative? I mean, what are you seeing so far?
I think it's, you know, it's hard to predict what he's going to do at any given point. And I think it's kind of useless to predict what he's going to do because you just don't know, and he changes his mind so frequently. But I think there has been a pattern emerging of there's a ton of billionaires and multimillionaires in this cabinet. I think it's an unprecedented level. I read somewhere that it's $14.5 billion in net worth so far, and he hasn't even filled it yet. So we have that on one side. And then on the other side, we have all these sort of activists. We have people like Betsy DeVos, who's a big school choice advocate, who has, you know, driven charter schools in Michigan and Michigan has seen the numbers for their charter schools go way down in reading and writing tests. People like Ben Carson, who's going to be leading HUD, and no one really knows why he was chosen for that post. He has no background in that.
I do, but I won't say it in front of all of you all.
Well, he said himself, and you know, he was asked on, I believe on Fox News, what his qualifications were, and he said he grew up in Detroit, and that was his one thing. You know, we've got people like Tom Price leading Health and Human Services. He is best known for campaigning against Planned Parenthood, trying to defend Planned Parenthood. So I think we're seeing kind of a lot of the pattern that we saw within the Trump campaign of this, you know, it's activism for conservatives, but it's also, you know, what's going to benefit wealthy Americans. And so that's always been kind of the central contradiction within Trump, is he has this populist narrative, but he, you know, he's a very uncomfortable messenger for that. He's extremely wealthy and has always touted his wealth, and that's always been his selling point, is that he's a successful businessman. And you kind of see him putting people like himself in his cabinet.
So, James, there's a line going around. I apologize. I don't remember who said it originally or wrote it. But it's that throughout the election, the media took Donald Trump literally but not seriously, but his voters took him seriously but not literally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are we seeing, and meaning, you know, that's why a lot of his voters, they're not worried about him breaking with orthodoxy here or there.
Yeah.
They basically know he's there to do a certain thing, to be against people they want him to be against, hopefully change things, you know, in general, the way they want them changed. Can you apply any of that to what we're seeing so far, some of the folks he's putting into office?
I think the original appointment of Bannon was the telltale sign.
Steve Bannon, the former head of Breitbart.
That he was appealing to his base.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the red meat. I mean, for me, as a student of black politics and a student of American politics, this would be something akin to the Black Panther Party actually winning a national election, becoming the government of America. Huey Newton out of Oakland runs for president, acting like Donald Trump did, and somehow winning because white folk decided they would look past Huey acting a fool the way they look past Trump acting a fool. And then Huey and the Black Panther Party come into power in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Or better yet, Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. And as soon as Farrakhan got into power, he appoints Khalid Muhammad as his chief advisor, his Valerie Jarrett. And the rest of the country, the Jewish population and everybody else in America should just be cool about it. Because Farrakhan is in charge. And Khalid is his political advisor.
Yeah.
For anyone who is a person of color, anyone who's in generally conscious about rights and human rights and about the democratic legacy of this country, this is ominous and frightening. To me, what the appointment of Bannon signaled was much larger and much more about a national moment in which I think the largest segment of the electorate made a choice. And we're only on the precipice of it, the tipping edge, that I think with the choices we had as a country, given the demographics of the future, between multiculturalism going forward and some kind of going back to what Trump imagined,
yeah,
that we have chosen the latter, and that basically 50 years of American history was reversed a month ago. That everything that was left, everything that was liberal, was repudiated, at least on the short term. And it seems to me that Donald Trump has put the liberals and Democrats in general in a real precarious position going forward. But I think it's also the case that going forward, the Democratic Party will have real challenges.
When it comes to Trump's who he's picking for his cabinet. You have to think that this creature, this Donald Trump, is a guy who, he's a businessman. He's always been a businessman, and he's going to go with his gut, and he's going to go, most importantly, when it comes to these cabinet selections or possible ones, he's going with the guy or the woman who has stuck with him. Now, here's the problem. Nobody was with him from the beginning. They were talking trash about him, which is ridiculous that Mitt Romney would be, you know, hanging, because this was the guy who was talking the most trash, and he wants to get this, you know, this job. So there was the selections that Donald Trump can make are very small if he's going to go with his gut and who he trusts and who's, and that's why you have Giuliani and Christie, although Christie was not.
Right, he's been apparently offered several, or was interested in several positions.
Yeah, they turned down several positions.
Yeah, okay. So that's something to think about. Why we're getting, you know? So what are you going to get? You're going to get Rex Tillerson's and these people, or some people we've never even heard of. Because it's
4,000 of them. And one I wanted to pick up on my point.
4,000 of them.
4,000 of these people.
Appointees.
Appointees. Okay. And I think what people don't realize is that this country made a decision, I think, to go, and you might think this is controversial, and I said some other things that were controversial here that proved out to be true around race and Trump. I think this country made a choice last month, to go toward an apartheid system. An apartheid race arrangement in America. Going forward in the next 50 to 70 years, to 90 years, the U.S. Census has told us that we have a demographic revolution coming. Mm-hmm. The Republicans have a demographic problem in America. The Democrats have a geographic problem, and that's what exposed them. I think it's a real issue going forward. I think the electorate decided that it is willing, through white minority rule going forward, if necessary. And Trump is the tipping edge of that ugly face to the non-white population that we are willing to do this if we have to, because many people of color were asking their, not, you know, white friends and others, please don't do this. Don't vote for Trump. You don't understand what this represents to us. And he was elected anyway. So I'm suggesting to you, as an intellectual point, that I think the electorate made a choice going forward as the white population continues to decline. Every other demographic in this country is exploding. Black population in America in the next 39 years is going from 45 million to 75 million in 39 years. The Latino population exploding. The Asian population from 3% to 6% is actually the fastest growing population. And so South Asians in particular. So we have all of these demographic realities. And I think, given the circumstances, given the alternatives between what Obama was trying to present as a way forward and Trump as a way backwards, this country decided, and it blew up all of its values. Most of the people in this room are old enough to remember not the Red Scare, but they read about the Red Scare. They might remember about McCarthyism. They saw the war on drugs. All of these things where many of the people in this room's lives were impacted by the surveillance state here in San Francisco. And now Donald Trump is just going to come into the White House and all of that history just means nothing? We're not worried about the Russians. We're cool with communism now. So this is phenomenal what we're experiencing.
Well, you know, I would. Steven. What you said earlier about that Hillary Clinton had run the great campaign.
The greatest losing campaign.
I disagree that she did, because she wasn't listening to any of what a lot of people were saying. And when you, an aside, when you bring up those demographics. Mm-hmm. I don't dispute those at all. Mm-hmm. But to everybody here in the Bay Area, that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
We go to Fremont, where there's a lot of South Asians, and everywhere. This is a bubble. This is a diversity bubble. But when you're talking that like that, somebody in Missouri or somewhere there don't know what you're talking about, and it'll be scary. Right. I don't know why it would be scary. I mean, you know, to me as a foodie, I'd be like, oh man, all these Indian food, Mexican food, all the Chinese food, all this stuff. That's great,
right?
That's the positive way of thinking. But Hillary Clinton did not run a good campaign, and I'll be somebody here who will sell you. And I'll preface this by saying I do. Identify myself as a progressive political journalist, so don't get mad. But I did predict this that Trump would win earlier in the year. I have a podcast, East Bay Citizen Podcast. You can go to April 28th, and I said it and I laid it out. But even before that, I just thought generally to myself, don't think about the candidates. You know, even the beginning of the year, I'm sitting there thinking. I'm hearing at the local level, people in Oakland and, of course, in San Francisco, too, talking about housing. And this is in the bubble now. This is where we're feeling good in as opposed to the rest of the country. But there's people hurting and people getting squeezed. And nobody seems to be doing it. City halls are siding with the developers who are not building affordable housing. It's getting worse and worse. So that's the look here. You imagine in the whole country where there may be in a Republican county where nobody is going to care about affordable housing. Who cares about this? And who cares about, you know, diversity or anything like that? Nope. She wasn't talking to those people. And I just thought we have how many Republicans did we have in the race? 15, 17 at the beginning, something like that,
right? 17.
17. And we had two, well, at this time we just had Clinton. I just thought, of all the people, one here on the Democratic side and all these on the Republican side, they're all saying, everybody except Hillary, put it this way, Hillary is the only one saying, let's keep it the way it is. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is changing it. We want to change it, whatever degree. We're going to go with, in the end, we're going to go with the candidate who says keep it the same? I don't think so. And it just gnawed at me
for
a long time.
Yeah, but and yet, she won more votes than any other presidential candidate except Barack Obama in 2012.
Right. And if she, in the wrong places. If she ran against Obama, if she ran against Obama and compared to anyone else who did, she would have came in second.
Yeah.
Behind everybody who's run for president pretty much since her husband, she would be number two behind Obama.
Right.
And so, again, I stick to my position. Hillary Clinton ran an excellent campaign. She ran an outstanding campaign. She defeated him three times in three debates and made him look bad three times. We've never seen that before.
Right.
The liberals would remember when Romney got finished with Obama after the first debate, the first cycle,
panic.
Half the country lost its heartbeat because they were like, oh my God, he's going to lose.
Right.
Look how bad Obama did against Romney. There was never that moment with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. She handled him in ways that no man could handle him. And again, it was the collaboration of men. And I think it is insane that Julian Assange is somewhere held up in a United Nations or an embassy because he's accused of raping a woman and can't go outside the building. And there's something amongst you lawyers and others, this concept known as fruit of the poison tree. Right. And to me, Julian Assange, if you accused of rape, I don't want to hear anything else you have to say. If you are a rapist, if you're being tried, if you're hiding out because you're accused of rape, you can't tell me about a political corruption. So to me, I don't understand how it is that Julian Assange has somehow gotten away, especially on the liberal left with this. This is criminal. We're now finding out today they hacked everybody's emails, but they only reported one side, apparently. And this is ominous because I said this before. So many of the young people were enamored with Bernie Sanders, where they get enamored with some old person that can't win every 4 years. And I wondered, and I don't mean to be offensive when I say that, but it's true. What would 25,000 or 35,000 of Bernie Sanders' emails look like? And how is it that he's become innocent? He's gotten this innocence from Lily White Vermont with 95% white population. And we're supposed to just trust Bernie Sanders is just cool. And then Trump, how many N-words do you think are actually in Trump's emails? And we haven't found one.
Well, and I want to go right into that. So there, it's assumed, I don't know if they have proof of this, that the RNC was also hacked.
Yeah.
So that the Republicans were hacked.
That's right.
Which has led some people to wonder, okay, if the Russians were somehow behind getting that information out from the Democrats, what do they have on the man who's about to be president?
Yeah.
Molly, a question from the audience, actually, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Someone writes, the 2016 election represents a huge failure of leadership by the Democratic Party leadership. Don't we need to replace Nancy Pelosi and focus on more fundamental, less partisan issues?
Yeah, well, I think, one thing going back to what we were saying about Hillary didn't hit the right economic notes throughout the campaign. She didn't speak to working class voters. I think a big part of the problem was she had to fight Trump at every turn. She was always having to respond to him, whatever his latest drama was. And that kind of took away from her, I don't think she didn't have the message quite like Bernie Sanders, but I think that took away from her ability to really communicate those things. And it wasn't an issues campaign. It was a campaign about personalities. Going back to Democratic leadership, I do think that a change of faces in the Democratic Party is needed right now. I think voters spoke pretty clearly about how they feel about Democratic leadership, and that's been stewing for a long time. People were unhappy with Debbie Wasserman Schultz for a long time before the email leaks came out in the summer. And I think having someone like Keith Ellison run the Democratic Party would be a really great change. He was the first Muslim congressman. He's young. He's progressive. He's from the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. I think that would send a really strong message to everyone in the United States, but also to those Democrats who supported Bernie Sanders, maybe those who voted third party in the general election or just didn't turn out to vote. I definitely think it's time for a change.
A generational change, is what I'm hearing some folks say, too. Keith Ellison, actually, that's a good point, because it's such an inside baseball thing to talk about. The person who's running a national political party, they're not a candidate. But
it's interesting to me that the media is actually holding him to a certain standard that they won't hold Trump to, that his affiliations with Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam and past beliefs that he held in the Nation of Islam are now being held against him, and he's now being held up as an anti-Semite for his association with Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, which, again, is phenomenal to me because we had plenty of people coming out to defend Ed Bannon saying he wasn't anti-Semitic. He wasn't anti-Semitic. And to me, that's a problem, like saying you don't beat your spouse. It's sort of like, wait, that's a non-starter. Yeah. That the president's chief advisor is not an anti-Semite is not a good way to start a government.
Stephen, Democrats, do you think they need to change, or is there a danger that they sit there and say, "Well, we did win more votes than the Republicans for president, and you know the demographics will work in our direction"? I mean, is there a danger for Democrats that they would be complacent instead of being energized?
I mean, in the East Bay, I've dealt with this, because if we had it actually could be a microcosm of what's to come, because you know if anybody's from the East Bay or known general Bay Area politics, you know for a long time the place was ruled by people named Bill Lockyer, Don Parada, Pete
Burton,
Stark.
Anything Burton.
Yeah, yeah. And so and slowly those guys went away. Some figured that it was time to go and save their legacy. Others did that, but then they had their wife ran for supervisor and things happen, and we don't want to talk about that. He'll come after me probably again. No. But anyway, we have Pete Stark, and he didn't go away. Mm-hmm. So Pete Stark stayed there for 40 years, and he kind of went off the rails. And we had a congressman or a candidate there, came out of nowhere, and ran a campaign. Pete Stark helped him by saying a lot of crazy stuff, and he just kind of, Eric Swalwell, congressman.
So he says a bunch of crazy stuff. He doesn't become president. But,
yeah.
Seriously, I have to finish that sentence?
Yeah, yes. So I've seen, and, we have a new generation in the East Bay of Democratic leaders in the Assembly, in the State Senate, and Congress. I think that's, there's something to be said for bringing in the new blood, and it's happened slowly. So, but I think nationally, I don't think it's happening slowly, and especially in California at the above, at the U.S. Senate with Nancy Pelosi, she has a good run. I'm on the fence with her. I'm not too sold on Keith Ellison, which is a congressman I dealt with. And I found him to be unbelievably like forthright, and he was like to the point where I was interviewing him in Oakland a couple years ago. I was like, "Do you know that we're on the record?" I mean, are you? And he started talking bad about whether Congressman Swalwell was progressive enough, and so I wrote that story, and then the next day, the chief of staff calling from the Midwest, he didn't really say, he didn't mean that, and so, but I did find him to be very candid, and he's a very intelligent and very, he's young, so I think
I would just jump in real quick and suggest that this is really odd politically, when you look at on the Republican side, Obama was born in the 60s, right, the first president we've had in the 60s, and you would think we'd go 50s, 60s,
yeah,
in that direction,
right?
But we went 30 years backwards on the conservative side of this.
Yeah.
So it's really phenomenal that Nancy Pelosi is being seen as someone that needs to move out of the way and make room for new leadership, when the successful formula was going backwards
to
old leadership, older leadership, and Again, Donald Trump amazes me because he's been a part of the political corruption of this system for the past 40 years.
Which he
and yet
says,
he continues to present
says,
himself yeah, as a political outsider. I think it's phenomenal. He's run for president three times. We keep acting like he's just ran this time. It's phenomenal what Donald Trump has done to this country.
Well, let's move to state and local stuff because we all know this. We voted. It took us 3 hours to fill out our ballots, right? There's propositions for everything. Some interesting candidates won. Stephen, what were some of the local election results that caught your attention?
Yeah, so we talked about Ro Khanna, and I think there's a lot to be excited about this guy. He
knows how to hack. I mean, that's
he's a
cool.
Russian hacker, so-called. He actually is pretty good with computers. He gives out his personal email to everybody. I mean, he actually will respond. I thought it was just an act. He does. He will. If you go to, I can't think off the top of my head. Probably shouldn't give it.
Probably shouldn't say it here.
But if you send him an email, he answers. And as far as I know, it's him. So he's definitely going to be he's going to really run with that Silicon Valley congressman thing. He's going to be the Silicon Valley 17th district representative, and that's what he's saying he's going to do. So, but we need to watch very very closely because he's very young. Mm-hmm. He's 40. And as I talked about Swalwell right next door, he's 36. So you both got these two young, dynamic, possibly, national figures. I'll give you something here. I heard that Swalwell might run for president in 2020.
Ooh.
It's the craziest thing I've ever heard. I discount it, but I would key in on that he's thinking that way, which, I'm of the opinion, I want the guy, even my guy that represents me on the local sanitary district. I want that guy to think he's going to be president one day. I figure he's going to do a good job, right?
Right.
All until he's the president, from the outhouse to the
literally
the outhouse to the White House.
I thought here in the city, Jane Kim and Scott Wiener, their contest was really.
So this was the contest for a state Senate seat between Jane Kim and Scott Wiener, both supervisors, and it looks like he is finally.
Yeah, he's got it clearly. And I actually thought she was going to win, but the establishment apparently in this particular case won out. She was endorsed by Bernie Sanders, and Bernie didn't come locally, as far as I know, to campaign for her. She was one of about nine people nationally that are actually these sort of Bernie surrogates, mostly people of color from around the country, men and women. And she was really admired here at the local level for the issue she took up. And Scott Wiener, again, held his own.
Well, these were two very smart candidates.
Yeah.
I mean, this was...
Yeah. It was sort of pick which of the two you wanted. In fact, I think it was Ross... one of the local political leaders around here was saying that they are so close to each other that they actually have resorted to attacking each other personally because they were so close politically, and they had come to that toward the end.
The word in Sacramento is they're very bullish on Scott. It is Wiener, right? Wiener.
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of the ultimate political wonk.
Yeah. I hosted a debate on campus a few weeks ago, their last debate, and the whole night I was so afraid I would call him Anthony Wiener. That was the only thing all night. All night, I was praying to Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, all of them. I said, please don't let me call this man Anthony, not one time. Just not once. I couldn't make that mistake once. So I kept saying, Scott, Scott, Scott.
Had it written in really big letters on his notes. Molly, what were some of the local or state elections that caught your attention?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is that Democrats have super majorities now in both the Assembly and the Senate. And I think that's going to be incredibly important, especially with Trump as president, and California is sort of trying to position itself as this resistance to the Trump administration, already introducing bills about immigration. I think we'll see some climate stuff coming up pretty soon. So I think that was a big one. And then there were so many interesting ballot propositions statewide. Obviously marijuana legalization was a big deal. The Gavin Newsom's gun package. I was surprised personally to see the death penalty, to actually speed up the process of the death penalty go through. That was an interesting thing. The plastic bag tax. There was just so many things on the ballot, as we all know. We all filled it out, I hope. but yeah, I think seeing how all of those new regulations play out is going to be really interesting.
Well, and I said this before the election that, you know, analysts, Larry Gersten, a frequent panelist here, has said that when there are a lot of propositions, people tend to vote no. But in this case, quite a few things got yeses. So that was interesting. What are you thinking about now? So the last time the Democrats had a supermajority in the state house, Governor Jerry Brown kind of found himself having to act as, if you will, the parent. No, you can't do that. No, we're not going to spend this or whatever. Do you think he might do the same thing, or that now that the economy is better than it was the last time, that he might approach it differently? Any thoughts on that?
I think he'll probably keep playing that role. We saw that even last session when he was vetoing things like parental paid leave, the tampon tax bill, and those were because of cost issues. So I don't think he's going to change from that position.
Okay. We had the supermajority. I don't mean we, I mean Democrats. it was like around 2012. Is that right? I think it was around. And that, the point is, at that time, you know, a lot of the talk was, are they going to overstep their bounds? Are they going to ruin this by just going, you know, way left? And I totally agree. It was Jerry Brown that was holding them back. But I think that caucus and that session was purposely pulling back, and they did. And it seemed to have worked out, and that was a new that I do. I'm thinking it was 12 because that was the first year when the new term limits came in for, you know, from 8 years. Now you can have 12.
Oh, yeah.
It seemed to have worked. So I'm gonna you know, on predictions later, but I'm gonna say that I think that they're going to it's gonna happen again the same way, where they're gonna be cautious. You know, there is a mod squad, so-called mod squad in Sacramento, who progressives just hate. I think
mod squad is in moderate.
Moderates. And when, you know, when I'm talking with Sacramento people, you know, it's usually from people in the East Bay, the East Bay's assembly members and state senate, they're telling me, you know, don't expect much. Infrastructure, don't expect much because the moderates are going to pull us back, even though we got a supermajority. So I think, I think that's a positive because my fear is that Donald Trump is going to demonize California and lampoon them in ways that we had seen. And if we have, from a political standpoint, if we have progressives just going, you know, going far too left, it's just going to feed more into it, and it could have a corrosive effect.
I mean, he would have nothing to lose by that. I mean, because California is so blue, it can be
right.
A punching bag for him.
Right,
at the same
right.
time, you know, California, Hillary Clinton is the president of California. I mean,
but if we get it to the point where he gives us a nickname, like Crooked Hillary, we are toast.
Okay. Someone asked about sanctuary cities, and that was something I wanted to talk about anyway. San Francisco, of course, is a sanctuary city. How many cities in the Bay Area? Are
Oakland, Berkeley. I think...
Is LA also?
LA is. Santa Ana is now. That was like last week.
Really? So they actually jumped on the bandwagon.
So they just...
They're not defending something that...
Right.
I wanted to talk. I mean, in it's obviously been a center of attention, both nationally. It became a big issue, partly because of San Francisco, and you remember the murder of a young woman by
Kate Steinle.
Yeah, Kate Steinle. And there was some thinking at the time that okay, San Francisco might change its sanctuary policy, but the city government doubled down on it. Some thoughts from each of you. Start with you, Molly. I mean, sanctuary cities. Do you think those might be changing, or do you think they're going to be under threat by Trump, or do you think that was a campaign thing like lock her up?
Right. Well, I think it was definitely an important applause line in all of his campaign rallies. He brought up Kate Steinle constantly, similar cases where an undocumented immigrant had been involved in some sort of crime. But I think you know, I think cities like San Francisco have already said that they're going to stand strong against it. I think it's important to make that point politically, that they aren't going to give in to Trump's threats. And I think, frankly, they see his threats as a little bit empty. First of all, it's important to understand that sanctuary city isn't an official designation. It means different things in different places. So just given that nature, I think it's hard for Trump to really put a blanket policy in place to fight sanctuary cities when that means different things. Secondly, there's not a ton he can do when he's saying that he's going to pull all federal funding in San Francisco, for instance. That has a lot of legal roadblocks along the way. There's precedent for that sort of thing being blocked. We saw that with Obamacare. It's a 10th Amendment issue. I think it's a real challenge to states' rights. So those are things that he's going to come up against. So I think, as of now, I don't see San Francisco or other cities backing down from it.
I had asked this question of Melissa Kane, who was on our post-election town hall. And because the number that's been bandied about is that, oh, San Francisco could lose $1 billion with a B. And she said, well, because of, you know, all these bureaucratic, and I'm saying that in a non-pejorative way, bureaucratic reasons, these are multi-year expenditures, et cetera, and there are all kinds of other things to it, there might be $1 million with an M that San Francisco could lose. And of course, you know, San Francisco, we've got a $9 billion budget. We'll give you $1 million, Mr. Trump.
Yeah, and I think we can anticipate what San Francisco will gain by being one of the havens that people can come to and also being projected as one of the places. I think with Jerry Brown saying that if Trump wins months ago, he said he'd build a wall around California. anybody remember that? Right? And I was seriously heartened by that.
Yeah.
Because I know Jerry Brown doesn't mean it literally, but he means it figuratively, that he will defend the Constitution against any sort of violations of people's rights in the state at the local level of power. And this is one of the ironies, Molly, that, you know, again, the conservatives are supporting the communists, and now we're seeing the liberals are, you know, are on the other side of this equation. This is, the liberals are now advocating states' rights.
Yeah.
We're all old enough to know that this is crazy. If Martin Luther King and his generation woke up and came back, I mean, those that are gone came back, they'd be like, what the? They'd be like, WTF? Get it? They know what WTF would mean. You get the point. It's just amazing what has happened, and the world has been turned upside down, and this is one of the examples of the liberals needing to promote a states' rights agenda, when that has been the entirety of 50 years of Republican emergence on the right, was to assert themselves in this particular way, from George Wallace all the way back to Strom Thurmond, all the way back forward to the local issue of Holder v. Shelby County that took away the 1965 Voting Rights Act recently.
Let's spend a few minutes talking about the year that was, 2016. We remember it fondly. Someone will. But let's kind of start by each of you. I want to talk about what you think it was the most important political event of 2016. Molly.
Well, it's hard not to say the election, but yeah. For the sake of not being boring with my answer, I think the death of Antonin Scalia was one of the most important.
You stole mine.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
You can have the same.
But yeah, that really raised the stakes of the election instantly. I think it turned out a lot of voters that wouldn't have turned out otherwise. It made, you know, getting a Republican in the presidency the most important thing to a lot of voters. So I think that really had an outsized impact on the election and the year as a whole.
Okay. James?
I would stick to Comey. What he did was unprecedented. And it's interesting to me that they say that the Democrats have said that the effect of what Comey did at the last minute when he declared that Hillary Clinton's campaign had, they had new emails. And then all of a sudden that, just deflated the liberals. And then all of a sudden, at the last minute, that Sunday before the election, he comes out and says, okay, Hillary's good. She's cool. Everything is cool. The Democrats took a sigh and they were like, oh, good. Maybe she won't lose the election now.
But that damage.
And they think that what this did, yeah. Hillary's campaign says that this drove this Sunday evening email drove the conservative movement out of panic that they were trying to rig and steal the election from Trump. by suggesting on Sunday that things that she actually was in the clear, that it drove a last-minute surge at the poll of Hillary opponents to make sure that there wasn't a trick being pulled on the electorate.
Okay.
So Comey's actions.
Stephen?
I agree with all these. And, of course, the election was the biggest. But I think the biggest story was the harbinger of this result was Brexit. I think Brexit was the one that told us what's going to happen later. And I think you can use it for other countries too, Philippines or
Italy.
Italy. So, and again, I said it earlier. We're not the only ones getting squeezed, and other countries are being squeezed by corporations and their government and co-opting their message, squeezing the populace. And I'm going to give a flyer to everybody on the Trump thing.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I think when you're squeezed so badly and you're just don't know what else to do, it's not the best time for making decisions. And I think that's what happened, regardless of... Hillary got more votes, but that was not the strategy of how you win the election. It's not how you get the most votes. It's how you win the electoral college. Yeah. So I think Brexit and immediately when Brexit happened, people over in this country were saying what if?
Well, you realize the thing that then everyone had been saying could never happen could happen.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Molly, the most important political person of 2016.
Well, I think Mitch McConnell has to be at the top of the list.
Really?
I think, you know, he
Senate
really made a statement.
Leader.
Senate Majority Leader. And he, you know, his whole agenda throughout the entirety of Obama's presidency has been obstructing President Obama, and I think that really sowed the seeds for someone like Trump to come up and follow through with what McConnell had been his message all along. He stood with Trump pretty early on, and after the primaries were over, he stood by him throughout all the controversies through the 2005 tape coming out. He, you know, blocked Merrick Garland's confirmation, so going back to the Supreme Court helped make that an issue in the campaign. And in this CIA story that came out over the weekend in the Washington Post, they said that McConnell was briefed on this information in September and decided it wasn't important enough to bring up. And I think that timing is very, very interesting. So I think he had a big role.
Very good. James, most important person?
I honestly, I'm trying to be, you know, creative and think of somebody interesting, but honestly, no one more than Donald Trump. I just think what he's accomplished is stunning on every possible conceivable level of American political history. And as much as I study political science, I'm much more of a political historian. Mm-hmm. And to me, Donald Trump was to be repudiated by the electorate. All of the signs said the electorate would repudiate Donald Trump historically, even if Hillary Clinton wasn't communicating with those blue states where she missed. Because this electorate has always historically rejected extremes, from Huey Long to Father Coughlin to George Wallace and Strom Thurmond and Sarah Palin and Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, who I don't think was an extremist, but Jesse Jackson, most famously, Barry Goldwater. This country has said no to Trump before, and it's stunning to me that he was able to just cloud up the entire process in such ways by just breaking every possible rule so that no rule mattered. That's what he did. It created a kind of chaos. The acting out against the person with the physical disability alone would have been a disqualifier for any candidate. This to me is one of those situations that just blows my head off, where we saw the first lady to be elect give a plagiarized speech on national television, and it was forgiven by the electorate.
You all have seen, maybe not, but the Facebook meme that when, you know, Donald Trump and President Obama met, they had their talk. When Michelle Obama and Melania Trump met, Michelle says, "Hello, I'm Michelle," and Melania says, "Hello, I'm Michelle."
I mean Cuba. I mean, we found out 3 weeks ago, and nobody's mentioned it since. But they mentioned that Donald Trump was violating the Cuban blockade, the Cuban embargo. That he violated the Cuban embargo, trading with Castro. And this man was elected. And so for me, again, I think, again, we don't like to talk about this in America, but the power of race in this election was transformative. Mm-hmm. To me, it was profound what this electorate did. Women didn't care about the history of their feminisms to the point where it would play out in Hillary's election. And that blows my mind, because the baby boomer generation of women, who have always been a Protestant group of people with a small p, rebels, historically, against men and any other sort of conventions. And as that generation ages out, it had an opportunity before it leaves fully to say to men and to these conventions, yeah, one more time, middle finger to you, our bras are burned, or whatever you want to use, you know, appropriate language. And yet they didn't, when they had the opportunity to see a woman in office on their watch, and they had the power to do it, and they delivered it, they did not deliver it. Okay. And that, to me, is why Trump should be considered the most phenomenal thing that happened in 2016.
Okay, Stephen, most important person?
Well, we like to, at this moment, we think that Trump's campaign to the end, and even now, just seems just all out of whack and doesn't make any sense. But we forget for most of the year that it was really out of whack, where it didn't even have, you know, it didn't even have people working in yeah, battleground yeah, states, and nobody seemed to know what it was doing. He was firing people. Everything was a mess. That's why I think the person of the year is the person who cleaned up that thing and actually brought him the presidency. Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah.
And I also...
She did a great job.
She put the thing together. Well, so, and I maybe you're keying in on some here, because I actually think it's a there's a little bit of progressive hypocrisy that the first woman to lead a, you know, a,
hear it out, flesh it out. He was just asking earlier if we had hecklers in the audience, and I told him no.
Okay, I will remind him. I'm the progressive.
Go ahead, Kellyanne Conway. Okay,
so,
well,
so that was my rationale. That was, and it was still. I mean,
she made him president. Yeah.
There was a lot to be desired, even in what she was able to do. But she quieted it to enough that got that train rolling in the right direction, where it was going this way and that way.
Okay, then last item, briefly a prediction about 2017, some political prediction.
Well, I don't really want to be in the prediction business too heavily, since everything I predicted about 2016 turned out wrong.
Right.
But I think one thing I can say safely is I think the confirmation process for all of Trump's nominees is going to be really lengthy. I think it's possible that maybe one or two wouldn't get confirmed of his initial picks. I think what's been really kind of crazy to see throughout this whole process is usually people who are vetted for these positions are vetted. They're, you know, they go through the ringer. Anyone with skeletons in their closet, like Tom Daschle back in 2009, it was a tax issue. You know, I can't even imagine what's going on with some of these people's taxes.
And they had to show their taxes.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yes. See, there's something that we still don't know about Donald Trump. So I think it's going to be a long, long hearing process. And I think Democrats have a real opportunity to you know, get back in the action here and, you know, fight.
Okay. Very good. James, prediction?
I think Trump will lose in the midterms of 2018, like every president has historically, except for Bush after 9/11 and Clinton after he was impeached. The country punished the Republicans in 98 for that. But we can predict that there'll be some losses for the Republicans. Much like we were talking about California, there may be some oversteps. And I think there will be, I think, at some point, people will realize that whatever high they got, the euphoria off of Trump's election, that at some point they realize it didn't change their lives.
Yeah.
And that's where you'll see a real percolating of trouble for Trump in his flanks, because he can't deliver what they need. Nobody can, a full economic transformation of this economy in a way that met the needs of people two, three generations ago. We just don't have that capacity with the, you know, for the ranks.
Sure.
And I think that's why he's in trouble.
Very good. Stephen, prediction?
Well, preface this by saying this is not the going on the limb prediction, but I think in 2017 that Dianne Feinstein will retire. And But this is a prediction. The representative from Southern California, Xavier Becerra, is going to be our attorney general. He will replace. I mean, it's not a for sure, but it is a certainty. There's nobody that's going to stop him from being appointed to that, to take over for Kamala Harris, who's now our senator. I think he's going to use that position to pound Trump.
Yeah.
Pound him every way he can, and then he's going to run
position
for that, for Dianne Feinstein's seat.
And I think this signals the California leadership protection, the anti-Trump place. I think this appointment signals that,
right,
too.
Right.
Well, we will see if these three are good predictors or not. Now let's move on to our news quiz before we wrap up the night. If my prize delivery person, Kimberly, will come up. This is a bag of chocolate. In fact, it's a bag of bags of chocolate. So that's what you can win. For those of you who have not done this before, I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. If you're right, Kimberly will deliver some chocolate. Or she'll eat it herself. So we need you to get these correct. Okay, so the first question. Who is calling for a boycott of the new Star Wars movie? Sir, in the back. The alt-right, they're claiming it's an anti-Trump movie. That's correct. Okay, in news from the corporate world, Mukhtar Kent has resigned as CEO of what company? Sir, way in the back. Coca-Cola, that is correct. Next question. Oh, that one's too easy. I want to ask you that. Here's one. A teenager in Macedonia claims to have made $60,000 doing what during the recent election? Ma'am.
He made the money by creating fake news.
That's right. I should repeat that. He made the money creating fake news for the American election. Mostly, he says, he aimed it at Trump voters. Take that as you will. Who blamed incendiary, her words, pro-Clinton rhetoric for death threats? Did anyone see this story? It's someone who was mentioned during this program. Someone who hasn't won already. Anyone want to take a guess? Oh, yes, ma'am.
Flint.
Who?
Flint.
No. Nope.
Conway.
Kellyanne Conway. That is correct. Okay, in a taped confession, who told police, quote, "I am guilty, we all know I'm guilty," unquote. Right there, ma'am. That's right, Dylann Roof, the accused Charleston church mass killer. Next, seeking re-election, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she favors banning what? Right here in the front. Face veils, the niqab or burqa. So while singing at the Nobel Awards ceremony, who forgot the lyrics to a Bob Dylan song? Sir, I saw your hand right away. Patti Smith, that's correct. I'll try to make sure I see both sides. How's that?
That's embarrassing.
So what Hollywood legend had his first ever drink of vodka while celebrating his 100th birthday? And sir, your hand was up.
Kirk Douglas,
that is correct. Okay, just two more. Samsung has issued an unusual update to its Galaxy Note 7 operating system. What will the update do? Someone, ma'am?
Will it help deal with the battery problems?
Not really. Right behind you, ma'am?
It will brick the phone. They're preventing the phones from charging.
That's right. It will literally render them inoperative to make them a little less explodey. Okay, final question. Okay. La La Land won the award for Best Picture on Sunday at what ceremony? Right here in front.
The Critics' Choice.
The Critics' Choice Award, that's correct. I do want to make a note. Someone has lost a very pretty earring.
Check your earlobe.
It's not mine, so come and see Kimberly afterward. Okay. So we're going to have, of course, a lot more news quiz questions and so much more to talk about on January 12th. Right here at the Commonwealth Club for our next week to week. Thank you to our great panel today, Molly Riley, Dr. James Taylor, and Stephen Tavares. Thanks to all of you for coming out today, everyone listening online and watching on TV. Have a great week. Have a wonderful holiday season, and we'll see you in 2017.